Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. We're going to meet the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University, Graham Ward. The Reverend Canon Professor Graham Ward, Regius Professor of Divinity at the University of Oxford, formerly at Manchester University, with a long career in the church, but an interesting life in connection with the world. Graham Ward, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you.
Graham, the reason I said that was because your current career trajectory is something quite surprising when I read your biography. You grew up as a kid at Salford in Manchester and had a pretty difficult childhood. You lived with your grandmother after the early death of both parents, came into the church through connections with the Pentecostal faith, and end up a Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford.
I know, it's not the usual story. actually, I'd just correct you on one. My mother died. My father disappeared when I was 14, so I've never seen him since.
Well, just give us the shortcut journey to where you've arrived now at Oxford, just so we get some idea of the issues that have driven you in this direction. What's been the driving niggle in your life that's led you to where you are?
Yeah, well, I think driving is probably the right word. I am quite a driven person. I mean, I then did well eventually at school and got a place at Cambridge where I read English with French, and was desperate to become a novelist. So when I left, I didn't intend to go into the church, nor did I intend to go into an academic career. I intended to go off to London and become a novelist, and that didn't happen. So the other thing that was really kind of calling in my life was to be a priest. So by that time, I was an Anglican. I went to see the bishop. He put me through theological training. I did very well in my theological training. And that was back in Cambridge, so that, you know, I was already publishing articles while I was finishing my undergraduate course at Cambridge in theology. When I came out, I then started work on a doctorate when I was being in the parish. And from that, the parish, the bishop said, look, you have your vocation is within academia. And I then got my first job at Oxford as a chaplain and tutor at Exeter College, moved to Cambridge, where I became Dean of Peterhouse, and worked with the Divinity Faculty, then went back to Manchester to take up a chair at Manchester and to take up the head of the School of Arts, Humanities and Cultures. And then from there, I was asked whether I would apply for the Regius Chair in Oxford, which was, you know, a huge honour and a huge risk, because I might not get it. And I decided, you know, go for it. That's always been one of my kind of mottos, if you like. And they said yes. So that's where I am now in Oxford. And it seems strange. You know, I look back, you know, there was one time in my life I used to think, never look down. That's a long way back. But in fact, going back to Manchester helped me to, because that's where I came from, helped me to put back some of my early life and resolve some of the things. I went back to live with my grandmother's house when she died and actually make it all kind of whole, if you like. And then before moving to Oxford, short and brief.
Well, Graham, it seems to me that your period as the head of the School of Arts, Histories and Cultures at Manchester is formative in your theological interests too, because from what I look at in the works you've written, and indeed what you're talking about while you're here in Australia, is critical for you is the place that Christianity occupies in the world in the present. And I mean in the world as it is, in the secular world, the place that Christianity has in our civilization, if you like, at the moment.
Yeah. That's really important to me. When I was at Peterhouse, as Dean of Peterhouse, I was still very much attached to being a priest within the church as well as being an academic. And the decision to go back to Manchester, but go back now to Manchester University, was a decision to move right out of any kind of the church paying my income or being in any church kind of pension scheme or whatever, and to be a part of a secular university doing a job where you were not training priests, you were not working with postgraduates who might become theologians necessarily or actually enter the priesthood. It was very formative. I mean, I wrote a book called Cultural Transformation, in which, you know, the opening is I now see that the theologian has to face both, he has to stand or she has to stand at the west door of the cathedral, where you're looking back one way to the east and to down through the baptism font right through to the altar, but you're looking also the other way out over the city. So my whole work from then on was very much engaged with, well, where are we as a culture? How do we read what's going on, and how does the church make some response to that? How does theology stop kind of just talking to other theologians and start engaging with what's out there in the world?
On Sunday night, we're talking to Graham Ward, a theologian, happens to be the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University. Graham, you raised some interesting questions. Even though perhaps for the last couple of generations, any sense of an overarching Christian narrative has been lost to societies in the West, there is still these deeply embedded cultural symbols that people sometimes aren't even aware of what they're playing with and toying with, yet they're so deep and resonant they just won't disappear.
Well, it's not even that they won't disappear. They're being recirculated in really quite amplified ways. I mean, you know, if you look at the three best-selling novel series over the last, say, 10 years, you've got Harry Potter, you've got the Twilight series, and now you've got the Game of Thrones series. In all of them, the supernatural, the world that's transcendent and beyond the kind of normal everyday world, is absolutely at the forefront. With Harry Potter, increasingly, you've got a kind of Christian heritage emerging, you know, most particularly within Deathly Hallows and the last volume. So, and with something like Game of Thrones, I mean, the whole of Game of Thrones, it seems to me, is all about the old gods and the new gods and what's happening. So I'm really interested. It's not just that this discourse is still existing. There's a major investments in this discourse that's actually going on.
It seems to be re-expressing itself as a kind of folk religion, though. You could almost go back to that great outpouring of grief when Princess Diana died. And you see this sort of upwelling of a sort of deep folk memory.
Yeah, I think that's true. I get a sense that, you know, there's a lot of work now been done on the decline in the church and its membership and whatever, and to do with the secularization theory, which is under enormous pressure at the moment. I know very, very few sociologists of religion who actually believe in the secularization theory anymore. But the idea that there was a sharp decline in Britain and Europe during the 60s, most pronounced during the 60s and early 70s. But it was a sharp decline also in trade union movements and in political party movements. In other words, this was part of a great kind of disenchantment with institutional life across the board. So what I get a sense of is that spiritually there's a lot of spiritual refugees out there that just can't attach themselves to the institutions that are there for the institutionalized religions. They're wary of them. They're not quite sure of what commitment might mean to them. But that longing is still there. I mean, it's not just Diana's funeral. I mean, look at John Paul II's funeral and the outpouring there and the massive kind of crowds that pull. Or you go to something like the pilgrimage route to Santiago Compostela. You know, you get hundreds and hundreds of people on that pilgrimage route that have nothing to do with the Roman Catholic Church. You find Muslims on that. You find Buddhists on that route. There is, I think, a whole kind of As I say, a lot of refugees out there who are looking for a kind of spiritual home. But the institutions that they're looking around to, you know, are not the most immediately attractive homes to actually start attending.
And it's something of the symbology that Pope Francis has latched on to, that yep. people see spiritual significance in the everyday and in the yep. meaningful gesture, not in the rituals of the institution.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's, you know, become a kind of champion for that way in which you see what my old supervisor, Nicholas Lash, used to call the E-string of the ordinary. And I think that's really quite an important aspect of what's actually going on. But within that, of course, there's a lot of fake pseudo-pop transcendence that's commercialized.
It goes back, in some ways you got the sensibility of this beginning to emerge in the 60s with that whole death of God thing, which in some ways was a revolt against the beginning of the revolt against institutions.
Yeah.
But Paul Tillich writes a book like On the Boundary, in which he says yeah. the place for the church can only be on the boundary between faith and doubt, between the institution and the society, and he was speaking about the personal journey, but that has seemed to grow in significance over the years, rather than disappear, as many said that, you know, Tillich and all these theologians, their stuff was just ephemeral and it'd wash away. There is something profound that was touched there.
There was, and it's one of those things that, you know, how interesting that if you look at the secularization theory, you know, the 60s was going to be the big kind of move out of all religion. And in fact, it wasn't. The 60s was the time of Vatican II. It was the time of great kind of exploration, as you're pointing to in Tillich. And the recognition with a number of people that, you know, the opposite of faith was not unbelief. The opposite of faith was certainty, that there were all these kind of concrete certainties out there that in fact, you know, someone like Wittgenstein pointed to towards the end of his life in his book that was eventually called On Certainty, that there isn't. And that foundationally, there are no certainties whatsoever.
Where does the church stand in this? You pointed to the notion of standing at the east door and looking both ways. Some people have said, sort of in missiological terms, in terms of where the church goes now, it's that really people have to learn that the church, in sense, is no longer in the building. The church has left the building. Some others might say a little more radically, no, the church has been evicted from the building.
I don't think the church has been evicted from the building, and I you know, within the church myself, I'm always ranting and raving to them, say, look, stop thinking that you're the victim of anything here. You're not the victim of anything. The church not being in the building, I think that's absolutely right. How it attunes itself to become the church again in any real way, I haven't got an answer to that issue. I've been asked about that several times. Well, how would you address the problem that, you know, Anglicanism has? Because I'm part of the Anglican Church. And all I can say is, you know, that we just got to get right back to some of the basics. And one of the basics is stop trying to keep the institution as it is on the road. It's got to change.
Because so much time over the 19th century and the 20th century was spent arguing inside the church about the way the church functioned, even down to sort of liturgical niceties, and you could divide yourself according to your liturgical preferences, and all of that stuff is seen as so utterly, utterly irrelevant.
No, and I think that's exactly right. You know, my work in trying to read the signs of the times out there in terms of the cultural environment within which we're situated. When I turn back towards the church, I don't see what it's doing to actually help in any particular way. It is helping. I mean, and I don't want to actually denigrate some of the kind of work that it's doing in its charity giving, for example. But it is still so self-obsessed with trying to get its own kind of doctrine pure and trying to kind of make sure that, you know, the people are still kind of up there paying their way within the church and making sure that the institution keeps on the road. You know, in some ways, you know, this is going to sound very controversial, but in some ways you kind of think, well, maybe it's just all going to go down to meltdown and actually find itself again as what it really is there to do.
Yes, find itself in the world.
Yeah.
That is being found quite often coming from the ground up rather than the top down. You see it in a lot of younger people looking at to live their faith inside a secular environment, whether it's in house communities or whatever. And it is basically that message that somehow Christianity has to re-find itself as part of a culture, not separate from a culture.
And I think there's a lot of truth in that. You know, the 13 years I spent at Manchester, most of them in senior management within a secular university. You know, senior people in those places are about keeping the institution as the institution flourishing. It's the nature of institutions that they don't like to see massive change actually happening to the institutions. And so it's not that they are resistant. I mean, most of the bishops I know are as desperate as anybody else to find out how we can actually go about turning this around. But it's going to have to be something really radical, because people are trying to find these things now at grassroots level and find alternative ways of understanding their religious yearnings and belonging in some way to, in my case, Christian communities. How might those communities flourish? At the same time, you know, part of the difficulty with some of these kind of ad hoc communities that are formed is that they're lacking the background of the tradition, that they're lacking some of the disciplines that are part of belonging to a tradition. And those disciplines are important. I wouldn't want those disciplines to actually go. So in some ways, the institution still maintains those disciplines, but they seem, you know, for the most part, for many people, just kind of empty formalities. So there's got to be a kind of way in which this is broached. But how that is broached, I don't know. I really don't know.
Some of it must be seen in the way in reading the signs of the times. If one looks at the signs of the times in the West, there is a sense of fear and apprehension. Whether it's when you look at the newspapers every day, whether or not it's the sort of demonising of the poor that you get in some journals, it's a sense that things aren't as they should be. I guess in Europe, it's particularly on the area of multiculturalism, where you've had this wave of people from different faith traditions come into the society. So there's a sense of deep uncertainty. Look, a church can feed on this in two ways. Either it can play into that and defend the borders and say we've got to maintain Christian civilization, whatever that means, or it can actually say, this is interesting. Let's see what the opportunities are here.
Well, and I'm obviously for the second camp here. I'm part of the cathedral at Oxford. And one of the things I enjoy about that cathedral work is that a cathedral becomes a kind of sacred space in the middle of a city, not just a diocese, and a city which is profoundly multicultural and profoundly multi-faith. And in being a sacred space, because it doesn't necessarily, we have pilgrims that come from all over with all kind of different kinds of faith, but it has to be involved in that, in those discussions about that multi-faith aspect of things, as well as being, you know, part of the multicultural aspect of the city. So again, I think there's a lot more kind of moving out and opening up conversations. I mean, to my mind, you know, the interfaith work that's done has barely begun, because we've got to learn how to live with each other and understand each other more before we start talking about really quite intimate and difficult things to do with what we actually believe and why we believe those things. But there is a real opportunity there. There's a real difficulty and a real danger there. Governments in Europe are turning away from state policies supporting multiculturalism. This has been a trend really since around about 2005. It's been a post 9/11 trend. David Cameron announced it as in Britain only in February. He said multiculturalism as a project by the government has failed. And he was only echoing there what, well, France has never really embraced that multiculturalism because of its policy of laïcité. But he was only echoing what was going on in Belgium, in Holland, in Germany. There's a movement away from multiculturalism as a way in which you try to find a new unity for the state, a new unity for civic community that's national, and a movement, therefore, towards the only other alternative to multiculturalism, which is assimilationism of one kind or another.
And that brings up another deeply discussed question, and that is, what is the nature of a civilization, and where, on what is it founded? There was a sense for perhaps 1600 to 2000 years that the West owed something to what was called Christendom. Does Christendom, or did Christendom, albeit disappeared now, contain any values which could be called civilizational universals? Are there such a thing as universals, and how are they to be negotiated in this sort of world?
Well, several aspects of that particular question. The first one, the historical aspect. You're right that, in fact, there's been a whole kind of civilization, very Western civilization, built upon Christendom. I think the historians now are making us see more and more that Christendom was a fraction of what was going on at the time. That Christendom was built upon massive persecution of the Jewish people within Europe at that particular time. And then it was also built upon crusades to keep the Ottoman Muslims at bay. It never really, although Marco Polo went out towards China, it never really engaged with those conversations there. And then when it did actually, you know, do its explorations through Spain and Portugal, it imposed Christianity upon various parts of the world to, in fact, the vast detriment, I mean, and even the liquidation of certain populations in certain countries. So I think actually historically, the idea of Christendom as being anything that we should be aspiring to in any way whatsoever, there are huge question marks about it. As for now, I think it's a very problematic concept to actually wield. And what you've got then is people like Samuel Huntington and his Clash of Civilizations, which actually creates kind of power blocks of religion that you know, in creating those, you create an imaginary in which these can therefore go at each other and war at each other. That there's no possibility for a global future unless we stop thinking in those kind of ways. We have to sit down and start listening and talking and stop these kind of reifications of things like Christendom, or even that there is one such thing as Christianity. World Christianities, global Christianities have shown us that Christianity, in it becoming indigenous, becomes syncretistic, and that's not a bad thing.
Does it mean that it's very difficult to have a conversation like, are there such things as human rights? Because for some people, human rights is dependent upon a concept of the person that derives from a particular civilizational tradition.
Well, I'm not sure to what extent it certainly is rooted within the Judeo-Christian understanding of human beings made in the image of God. But I think there is the sense of the sacredness of the human, the religious sacredness of the human, is there in other religions as well. It's not just within the Judeo-Christian tradition. So my own sense is that we need human rights. I am not going to actually deny that we should in any way try and get rid of benchmark notions of what human dignity might look like in the world and protect those who are most vulnerable from having those rights being violated in any way and their dignity therefore being undermined. But in fact, we do have to recover, I think, something of the religious and the sacred nature and the sacred foundation of those rights, because the rights in themselves, they only come in to actually have any prominence on the whole when they're violated. Most of them are negative rights rather than positive rights. And some of the rights are just not possible, like the right to work, for example. It's just not possible within our economic situation at the moment in places in Europe to actually fulfill. So we've got the language of rights I don't want to expunge in any particular way. And I don't want the critique to go all the way down such that we say, OK, we've got to begin again. They're hopeless. These are benchmarks that, in fact, are at least there as benchmarks for human dignity that we must keep. But we must deepen them. We must deepen them. I remember being out in Moscow and went to the Orthodox monastery of Sergei Passad and was at a Eucharist there in a very beautiful church. And the deacon came out to bow low to the congregation and sense them. And the student who was next to me, because I didn't really understand what was going on, said to me, you know, he is bowing low to the image of God in you. And said it almost broke my heart, because I just thought, well, this man doesn't know me. I could have come with all sorts of criminal backgrounds or whatever awful atrocities I had done. And I realized that he was not bowing to me. He was bowing to the image of God in me. And it does seem to me that if we could get that sense of people being made in the image of God, then we wouldn't be leaving women and children with their throats slit on Syrian streets.
Graham Ward, we're near the end of our time, but just finally, at a personal level, a reflection from you, then what is Christianity for you, and why do you remain in the centre of the Christian tradition?
That's a very hard question, and a hard question because my Christianity does not rest upon me. It's not an act of my will, if you like. I often think that sometimes there are times I actually just don't understand where we're going and or where I'm going, but Christ's faith in me holds me in my Christianity. It's profoundly important to me because of the way in which I believe that there is a formation that can make me into a better human being and can make, therefore, me and the communities in which I belong better forms of human being, which will be forms of human being which are reaching out to other human beings and to creation more generally. And that's my hope. My hope is, you know, that then at the end of my time, a difference will have been made, but it can't be just a personal difference. This has got to be something beyond personal difference. And so it's got to be some contribution to an overall providence of God's love within the world.
Graham Ward, Regius Professor of Divinity at the University of Oxford, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday
Night. Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.
Let's just wind up shortly.